Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says that a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Over the years, there have been many debates about the meaning of this amendment, but in 2008, the Supreme Court heard the case of District of Columbia v. Heller. The court split its vote 5-4, with the majority ruling that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to possess firearms, not just when you're participating in a state militia, but for other purposes too, like self-protection in your own home. Is that the right interpretation of the Second Amendment? How do you figure out how to interpret a document like the Constitution? Is there even a single correct interpretation to be found? I'm Alex Racy, and here to answer these questions with me, as always, is John Farrell. Hey, John.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well, sir. And yourself?
I'm good.
Good.
It's only a few weeks since our last podcast, so it feels like we're back on track.
Very much so.
Any news you want to share with people who might be listening about your life?
I have not fired any firearms since I saw you, or in fact ever in my life.
You've never fired a gun in your life?
I don't think so, no.
I haven't
no,
either.
I actually have... I may have fired some form of the carnival target shooting.
I see.
I think I have.
Was it a real gun? Or
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's so long now that I just don't remember.
I find that amazing that you don't actually know whether you've ever fired a gun. I mean, how young were you that you could
not
remember
this? Well, I must have been 12 or something.
You were perhaps shooting a gun when you were 12.
I'm not going to mention exactly how long ago that was, but it was a considerable distance.
And anyway, the news is no gun since then.
No. I think it was a gun. I think it was a real rifle, actually.
Now I think you just don't know, and you're maybe making this up.
It may be as murky as the Constitution itself.
Perhaps this could be our new opening, is that we tell stories, maybe about each other,
yes,
and the listeners have to guess whether they're right.
Well, you know, that's the kind of thing that people like.
I was going to tell a story about how you have been selected for that Mars mission with the Mars One company, but we'll save that for next time.
We'll save that for next time.
Okay. We're going to talk today about the Second Amendment and the case District of Columbia v. Heller. But before we do that, we should probably summarize the court rulings. So the Second Amendment says that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And it's important to know from the start that in these court decisions, the people who write the opinions refer to the first part of that as the preamble, and the second part is the operative clause. So the preamble is the part that says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And then the operative clause is the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And in my view, here's this sort of initial problem that the court faces. This operative clause refers to the right to keep and bear arms. And it refers to it almost as if we already know what it is. It just talks about the right to keep and bear arms. And what the court is doing is trying to figure out what this right refers to. So the majority opinion, which was written by the late Judge Antonin Scalia, he thought that in order to figure out what this right refers to, we've got to ask how people at the time would have understood this phrase, the right to keep and bear arms. Interestingly, he's not interested in the intentions of the founders. I think his judicial views are often caricatured that way. People say that Scalia was interested in the founders' intent, but actually he doesn't care much about intent. He cares about how an ordinary citizen of the time would have understood it. And his answer that he gives in his majority opinion is that the right to keep and bear arms refers to the common law right to own firearms, not just to participate in a militia, but to own a firearm in your own house for self-protection, for hunting, and so on. He does think that the preamble is somewhat important. He thinks it announces the purpose of codifying the right. So he thinks that, in other words, the framers were telling us that because they were interested in a militia, they were going to protect this right to keep and bear arms. But he doesn't think the preamble limits that right and makes it just a right to keep and bear arms when you're in a militia. So that's the majority opinion. The minority opinion was written by Justice Stevens, and he seems to agree that we should be puzzled by this question, what is the right to keep and bear arms, which is being referred to. He actually acknowledges that at the time there was a common law right to keep and bear arms for all kinds of purposes, but Stevens says that that is not the right that's being enshrined in the Constitution. Instead, he thinks the Constitution protects the right to keep and bear arms insofar as it's necessary for activity in some sort of state-regulated militia. His evidence seems to be partly that he thinks this is how the phrase would have been understood at the time, But he is actually a little more interested than Scalia is in the intent of the framers, which he also thinks was not to protect all rights to keep and bear arms, but instead they wanted to protect specifically this right that was necessary for a militia. Stevens also has another wrinkle in there, which is that after making his case, he says, well, maybe people aren't convinced that I've got the right interpretation of this phrase. And he then says, but maybe it's ambiguous. But if it is ambiguous, then we should look to the preamble to disambiguate it. And so he thinks the preamble, which clearly refers to state-regulated militias, once again is some evidence that the right to keep and bear arms is just the right to keep and bear arms insofar as you need to participate in a state militia. So that would be my summary. Does that match with your understanding of the case?
Yes, more or less.
Well, eventually we want to talk about which of the two opinions we found more compelling, but maybe we should come at this a little bit obliquely and start by talking about just the style and the method that's being used by each side. So when you looked at the style and the method used by Scalia, how'd that seem to compare to you to the Stevens method?
Well, it is very interesting to start with that they do have very different assumptions about how you establish the original meaning of the text. Scalia thinks of, he says that what would the voter have understood at the time. And he's talking about the words in the amendment, the individual words and phrases, not necessarily about the entire thing, right? You wouldn't have expected the voter of the time to have had a doctrine about whether preambles contribute to the operative meaning of the entire sentence, or whether they are simply there to establish a purpose, even though the actual action that's been taken by the amendment might go beyond the purpose itself. So it's not as if Scalia thinks that the voter of the time is able to parse things in that manner, and to have convictions about how language is used in legal documents typically. But it's about the meanings of the words.
Right, and that is true. It's very striking when you read his opinion that there really just are sections and subsections about individual words and what they would have meant at the time.
Yes. He atomizes the amendment.
Right.
Whereas Stevens wants to think of it as more as a complete sentence, with the two parts bearing more crucially upon each other. He's more interested in intent. And so he's more willing to look back at things like what evidence we have about the discussions at the time, the revisions that were made in various proposed amendments, and so on, which don't tell you what it actually says now, but gives you a better sense, perhaps, of the ambit of considerations that were in play. So, in some sense, Stevens has a richer range of evidence at his disposal. And, of course, there's no absolute answer to which one is a better method.
Right.
Right? It's not as if the Constitution itself can settle such a matter.
Yes.
It doesn't include rules for its own interpretation. And if it did, we need rules for those rules, and so on. At some point, one is using one's general sense of how things should go.
And you know, I think you've correctly highlighted that Stevens has, as you called it, a richer method than Scalia, or more resources at his disposal, because he's not just interested in the plain meaning at the time, but also the framer's intent. But did you think that this actually was something that affected the outcome of the case? Because, you know, we hear a lot about how there are these different methods of interpretation. But I have to say, for my own part, it seemed to me that more or less Stevens and Scalia are on the same page about method, and that it didn't make a big difference in the case. Did you feel that way?
Yes. I didn't get the sense that the choice about method was determining the reading of the amendment in this case. I think it might in other cases, but not here. One of the most impressive amicus briefs that supported Scalia was one that did a lot with the history of the framing and made arguments that suggested that Scalia's interpretation was a sound one. But he didn't make use of that very much. And I assume that's because he just doesn't want to encourage that kind of use of evidence.
Right. If you look at his book, for example, on judicial interpretation, he's very clearly not interested in framer's intent. He thinks there are various problems with it. You can't know what it is. It's often contradictory and so on. And so to his credit, I suppose he was being consistent in that case. There was this brief that would have been helpful to his side of things, but he didn't really draw upon it because he's not interested in the framer's intent.
Right. We say that Stevens' method has a wider ambit to it, or more choices. On the other hand, Scalia obviously more likes to revel in the details of past language. He has longer quotations and is extremely dependent upon his ear for reading the language of the past. So that's another obvious difference in style.
Right.
One also notices Scalia's comfort in using wit and sarcasm, in his opinion, more than Stevens.
Sure.
And one might think about what that tone means for judicial procedures and its influence on the public as a whole.
Right. Well, let's get into this a little bit, because this was actually something which at first didn't bother me, and then I sat down to think about it, and it began to bother me. So you're referring to these points where both Scalia and Stevens, both sides, will sometimes say things that are sarcastic or they're kind of harsh. So, for example, at one point, Scalia refers to one part of Stevens's opinion as grotesque. He says that a certain interpretation has never been heard of on this side of the looking glass. There's a point, I think, where Stevens...
Oh, the rabbit hole.
Was it the rabbit hole?
Yeah.
Something like that,
which has become a very popular phrase. We're going down the rabbit hole.
Stevens refers to parts of Scalia's interpretation as overwrought, and so there are these things happening on both sides. Now, at first it didn't bother me, I even laughed, but here's why, after reflecting on it, I think it bothers me. So, think about what a person is doing when they refer to a point of view, not just as wrong, but as silly or ridiculous or grotesque. The reason you do that, consciously or unconsciously, is you're trying to get your audience to stop thinking about that opinion, right? So if I just tell you something's wrong, you might think about why it's wrong, or you might ask me why it's wrong, and I have to defend myself. But if I just tell you it's ridiculous, what I'm saying is, we don't have to think about this. It's beyond the pale. And the reason I don't like to see the Supreme Court doing that is that I think this is a big problem in society right now. We conduct our public discourse in a way where we're not engaging with each other, and we're actually trying to get people to think that the other side is full of idiots who we don't have to take seriously. And so, look, these two or three little bits of sarcasm in an individual Supreme Court case are not going to change public discourse. But it all adds up over time, and I really didn't like seeing the Supreme Court encouraging this bad habit, which we already have and we should be trying to get rid of. Do you think that's an exaggerated reaction on my part?
Well, let me take another tack with it.
Okay.
Literary satire has been, through the centuries, often an effective weapon in changing the way people think and providing perspectives of various kinds. You might think of something like Animal Farm by George Orwell. Would that fall to the same critique? Would that be objectionable for the same reasons?
Well, I think that although Animal Farm is not, you know, a straightforward argument and engagement with reasons, I would think that what Orwell's trying to do fictionally is to try to communicate in perhaps some sort of metaphorical way the reasons for being critical of a certain way of organizing society. So he is actually trying to engage with your intellect and give you reasons. And that, I think, is different from just calling an opinion grotesque or ridiculous when what you're trying to do is to get your audience to stop thinking about it.
Well, here's another example that you might want to comment on.
Okay.
In Gulliver's Travels, we have the people who break their eggs on the small end and the people who break their eggs on the large end.
Uh-huh.
The big endings and the little ending. Right? And this is like the difference between Protestants and Catholics. They both have ridiculous, arbitrary ways of doing things, which they've erected into glorious doctrines. And that's a way of ridiculing them. How does that strike you as a form of argument?
Well, I guess I haven't read this in forever. Actually, I don't even know for sure if I ever read Gulliver's Travels or if I just heard about it so many times that I feel like I've read it. But we'd want to look back at it. So when a person reads Gulliver's Travels, do they come away having, you know, learned something about this debate? Have they had their attention called to a fact, which is that the difference between Protestants and Catholics is rather small, or as you put it, that some of their choices in the way they run their churches are arbitrary? That seems to me like communication of information through satire. It's not an attempt to shut down rationality. Although I admit that if we went back and read this passage, maybe it is a kind of conversation stopper. Maybe Swift is just trying to say this whole debate is so ridiculous that we should stop thinking about it. I don't know.
I think it's both, and this is why Swift is a great writer to me. It's both a very pointed intellectual critique and a very annihilating form of humor. I suppose the problem with Scalia and Stevens when they become petulant is they're engaging in it in what is, if it works, a thoroughly rational and methodical form of argument. But then they're augmenting it with this other element which belongs elsewhere.
Well, and some people have pointed out that the Supreme Court, more than any other branch of government, has this potential to be a kind of model of civic discourse. So, you know, in the legislative branch or in the executive branch, when you're running for office or when you're in office, you can say anything you want. You don't have to give reasons for what you say. Or if you do give reasons, you can give any reasons you want. You can advocate a position just because it's good for you or the people who are on your side of the debate. You can say that you're hearing voices. You can say anything you want.
And Donald Trump has proven this better than anyone ever has.
Right. We're in the middle of a time where Trump and others, too, just defend their positions in whatever way they want. And some people have pointed out that a great thing about the Supreme Court is that it doesn't work that way. So if you come before the Supreme Court, first of all, you have to give an argument. If you just say things, no one's going to take you seriously. And moreover, there are rules on what kinds of reasons count as good reasons in a court. You can't walk into a courtroom and say that the court should decide a case in one way rather than another because it's good for you or because it's good for the people you support. There are certain kinds of public reasons and legal reasons that you have to appeal to. And so that's why many people have thought it's more of a model of civic discourse. We get together, we exchange reasons, but not any old reasons, a certain kind of public reason that we can all agree on. And so since the Supreme Court does have that potential to be the best branch of government to serve as a model for civic discourse, it's perhaps particularly disappointing to see the justices degenerating into this kind of sarcasm and name-calling. Well, maybe we should get to our understanding of the opinions and talk about who, in our view, made a better case. Initially, before I read this case, my gut instincts were entirely with Scalia. Just on the gut level, I think I'm some form of originalist. I think that judges, of course, are not supposed to be writing new law. They're supposed to be applying law. And it seems natural that if you want to know what a law means, that you would ask what it meant at the time. I mean, for instance, if I read a line of Shakespeare and I didn't know what it meant because I didn't understand the words, the natural thing to do would be to ask what the words meant in Shakespeare's day, and that would tell me what that line meant. And the same thing seems like a straightforward method in constitutional interpretation to me. So that's one thing that inclined me towards Scalia. Another is that I think when I just thought about this phrase, the right to keep and bear arms, it sounded to me like an allusion to a common law right to keep and bear arms for all purposes, including personal purposes in your home, self-defense, and so on. And so I was with Scalia initially on the idea that this phrase just sounds like a description of a general right to own a firearm. And then finally, I also sort of instinctively agreed with him that the preamble part of the amendment doesn't seem to limit or define the operative clause. Instead, as Scalia says, it seems like the amendment announces the purpose for which it was enacted, and then it tells us what the law is, but I'm not sure the purpose should limit our understanding of the right. So here's another little comparison. You know, you and I are both teachers. We write syllabi, which are essentially sets of rules for our students. So suppose I wrote on a syllabus, because students often encounter unexpected personal difficulties, every student in my class is entitled to turn in one paper a week late without penalty. Okay, so that sort of has a preamble and an operative clause.
Yes.
Now, imagine a student shows up and he hands in a paper a week late, and I say, well, I'm really sorry, there must be something going on in your life, and I'm sorry that happened. And he said, oh no, nothing's going on. I'm just handing it in late because every student's entitled to hand it in a week late. Now, has he broken the rule or not? My instinct is that he hasn't. I announced a purpose for my rule. I said, well, look, students often have personal problems. But then the actual rule was, every student in my class can turn in a paper a week late. And it didn't say, turn it in a week late if they're having personal problems. And in the same way, the Second Amendment seemed to me to be a description of a general right and a purpose, but the purpose didn't limit the right. Okay, so that was all my gut instinct.
There is a little bit of a shadow there, which is that one does feel that the student is violating the spirit of your policy, even though he's doing so in a way that is legally unimpeachable.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, it's in that example, it seems like the student is sort of knows what the spirit of the law was and is deliberately flouting it. But do you agree with me that the student hasn't actually broken the rule?
Yes.
Right. And that's how I initially read the Second Amendment. So then I read this case, and actually Stevens changed my mind a little bit. And it's for a couple of reasons. So first of all, Stevens cites some evidence. Actually, it's research done by other people, a group of linguists. And it indicates that this phrase, to keep and bear arms, was very much a militaristic phrase at the time. It really did mean keep and bear arms in a military context. And I'm not sure that his evidence completely overwhelmed Scalia's evidence, but it at least cast doubt on the idea that this phrase, to keep and bear arms, refers unambiguously to an absolute right to have firearms for any purpose. And then, once the historical evidence is ambiguous, then I found myself drawn to Stevens' point that we need to settle or resolve the ambiguity by looking to the preamble, which talks about a militia. And so, once we have this ambiguous law, maybe we should think, well, the preamble at least gives us a hint that what we're referring to is a right to keep and bear arms in this military context.
I mean, I'm not any kind of expert on U.S. history, but I have read a lot of literature from the 17th and 18th centuries.
Right.
And I've known that phrase since I was a kid, keep and bear arms. And as I've read a lot of English from the past, my general sense was that it referred to action in an army or some such organization. More naturally, then, it referred to using arms for self-defense.
So you maybe are a little bit different from me in that Stevens' evidence for me at least raised the possibility that the evidence is ambiguous, whereas you feel that actually, on the whole, given your knowledge of 17th, 18th, 19th century literature, that you're actually more convinced that this phrase is probably a pretty militaristic phrase.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think it's commonly a militaristic phrase.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell you how often it's used else otherwise. The linguist report says almost never, so that's fairly strong. And they give the most inclusive and, to me, persuasive account of the language that we get in the case.
And if we have any sort of ambiguity, or in your case, maybe even a sort of preponderance of the evidence on the side of this being a militaristic phrase, then we also probably have to start taking account of some of Stevens's other points. Among them, he cites this legal principle of stare decisis, which is basically a principle which says that you shouldn't change the law, at least not radically and unnecessarily, but instead should stick to precedent unless there's a clear reason not to. And Stevens seems to think that, you know, if the evidence is ambiguous or unclear in certain ways, then the court should not overturn all of its previous rulings, which had actually interpreted the Second Amendment so that it only referred to a right to keep and bear arms as part of militia work.
Yes.
Did you find that convincing, the stare decisis argument in particular?
I would have had to read these earlier cases, and I have to say I haven't done that.
Yeah. And maybe for you it was unnecessary because I think you're more convinced than I am that it's just kind of clear that the phrase to keep and bear arms is a military phrase.
At least it's very plausibly so.
Yeah.
It's certainly not obviously not a military phrase. That seems to be the more natural reading of it. And I agree with you that people at the time would have thought they had a right to bear arms in or to use arms personally.
Yeah.
It was largely an agrarian society where people did hunt and they lived out in the on their farms and so on, and they had to protect themselves. It was a frontier society.
I see. So you're saying there was this common law right, but in fact it was so well known and it was not under threat, and so there would have been no need to codify it in the Constitution. Instead, the only thing that would have gotten codified in the Constitution was something controversial, namely something about militia service. That's the idea.
Yes, I mean, the Constitution makes a point, the Bill of Rights makes a point of saying that unenumerated rights still belong to the people.
Yeah. Well, since we've talked about our evaluation of the case, maybe we should move on to a few other questions. I know that one that you're interested in is the question of whether it's a good idea for us to even be bound or guided by this 18th century document. And I think you and I disagree about this, so maybe I'll let you go first.
Okay. Well, I guess there's a lot of hagiographic language that surrounds our Constitution and our sainted founders, and many people connect the fact that we have this particular form of government and with its Constitution with the greatness of America, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I wonder how necessary that is. We can look at England, which has a different constitution, used in the older sense of a form of government, right?
Right.
But it really initiated the culture of, the modern culture of democracy and liberalism. And it has spread all over the world. It's in Canada, very clearly, and Australia, New Zealand, other Anglo-Saxon places. And then it's been disseminated much further than that.
Right.
Most of them don't have this kind of constitution. So I'm not so willing to attribute America's specialness and the character of our political culture to the existence of the Constitution.
So that would show that you don't need a constitution like ours to have a successful democracy. But does that mean that it's bad for us to be guided by this old document?
Well, no, I don't think it's bad. I don't think anyone could come up with a convincing balance sheet and say, well, here's the total on one side and here's the total on the other. But I do think it has obvious advantages and disadvantages. And the advantages that it does make very explicit, in a very contentious and divided society, some of our rights. So I'm not anti-constitutional, but I also don't have the sense that it is the key to all great things.
Right. I guess I came at this from a different perspective, which is the perspective of a political philosopher. So when you ask, or anyone asks, is it a good idea to be guided by this old 18th century document, I immediately think about its legitimacy. So there's this old problem in any society, the problem of political authority, which is, why does the government get to rule over us and make all these laws that highly constrain our lives? And the standard answer in a democratic society is that they get to do this because we've given them that power. So in some sense or other, the power flows from the people to the government. Now, then you get into some complexities, though, which is that this founding document from the 18th century, first of all, was not democratically enacted. And moreover, there's the other problem that it's so old that even if people long ago agreed to it, it doesn't seem like we agreed to it. And so you can't justify following the Constitution in the straightforward way of just saying, well, we all agreed to it, because we didn't all agree to it. But I still think there is a strong case for treating it as a binding political document. Part of that case is just utility, right? So if you were to throw out your founding documents, you wouldn't have any way to run your society, and there would be chaos. But also, I think there's, even if there's not explicit agreement to it, I think the fact that we're all relatively content with it, that we acquiesce to the rules of the Constitution, shows that there's a kind of consent going on. And when you combine that consent with the utility of the document, it seems to me there's a pretty strong case for having your society bound by it. I don't deny that there are the problems that you mentioned, but it does seem to me from the political philosophy side, you can make a pretty convincing argument for this being a legitimately binding document on society.
Well, it's good to have a legitimate form of government. I agree with that. It's good to have a form of government that people will respect as legitimate.
Yeah.
But there are other ways of coming up about that.
There are, and I should say that listening to you, you know, changed my mind a little bit, or gave me a little bit of pause, because what you were really reminding me is that there is just something slightly odd about using a 200-year-old document to run your society. I mean, take this as a comparison. Suppose we were studying, I don't know, the history of the Roman Empire, and we found out that they had certain problems, and then we wanted to know why couldn't they solve these problems. And the answer was that there was a 200-year-old rule, and they just kept following it, even though it wasn't good for them anymore. That would seem bizarre, right? We'd react to them by saying, well, why are you just following this old rule? Why don't you just give it up? And I can imagine that, at least to some people, the Constitution might look that way. They might say, look, you got this 200-year-old document, and if it's standing in the way of social progress, as maybe it occasionally does, why don't you just set it aside?
We are a relatively young nation. We're a very old democracy, but we're a very young nation.
Right.
And so most things in America were set up by a literate culture that we're fully informed about, or pretty fully informed about. And so all kinds of things that were just very arbitrary from the start have been set very firm. The states, for instance. Right? I mean, it's very odd, for instance, that Rhode Island, my home state, which has fewer than 1 million people, has 2 U.S. senators. And California, 30 million, is it? 30 million people in California, yeah. You also have 2, so Californians have 15 million people have to share a U.S. senator in California.
Right.
Whereas in Rhode Island, it's only 500,000.
Right.
And, you know, I know from personal experience that I can actually access my U.S. senator in Rhode Island pretty easily. I imagine it's quite a bit more difficult here.
Right.
And that is one of those things that is originally very arbitrary, gets set very firm, but because our very recent and highly legalized system.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just there, and it's not going to change because you need an incredible effort and arraignment of interests to change it. And so much of American system is like that. In many ways, it seems very unfair. And I'm not saying it could be changed. It is very legitimate. But when you step outside it, the oddity of it, I think, is illuminating.
Right, right. Well, I also wanted to ask you about something that you once mentioned to me, which is that you thought there was some sort of comparison between the Supreme Court and the Oracle at Delphi. And I don't know if you mean this as a joke or if it's serious, but I want to hear about this. How is the Supreme Court like the Oracle at Delphi?
Well, let me say a little bit about the Oracle at Delphi, which is a town in central Greece. It was known, it was thought of as the center of the world in Greek days, the Omphalos, or navel of the world. And there was an oracle there for about 1,000 years. It lasted a very long time. And you would go there with treasure and make offerings to the oracle and ask questions. And the oracle would answer your question in verse, and often extremely riddling verse. Verse that didn't have an obvious meaning. And the oracle actually was a woman, and a woman chosen, an uneducated woman, who was thought not to have political opinions. So obviously it would be the god speaking directly. And there are some, I think there are some interesting coalescences between our court and the Delphic Oracle, because it is all about riddling interpretation. You get a riddling phrase in the Constitution, and the framers have made their meaning as clear as they might, and so we have the interpreters. We're trying to assign a meaning to these riddles. And people take it very seriously. When they go off and they invade countries or don't invade them, or propitiate in various conflicts rather than continue them. They take all kinds of important steps because of what the Oracle has said. And very often, the only way to get on the Supreme Court is not to have said anything before, right? To be practically unknown.
Right.
Like the women who were chosen because they had no interests.
Right. Because if you've expressed clear legal opinions, then you'll get voted down because people don't like your take on constitutional interpretation.
That's right. And of course, there's a presumption that you're not being guided by interest. But there were constant accusations that the Oracle was being bought off, that the Oracle favored Sparta, etc., etc. So even though the Oracle had this whole machinery of objectivity and speaking directly from the gods, people constantly questioned it, even as they still respected it. So it had enormous legitimacy. It had long-standing cultural legitimacy because it actually did settle things. Whether the solutions were really good or bad, whether they were actually preferred by the gods or not, it did settle matters. And that's, you know, that's ultimately the similarity. Whether these decisions really are guided by anything that was originally valid, or whether we're getting back to their original meaning or not, you know, there is at least temporarily a decision when the court rules. And that's a large part of the value of laws and institutions like this. They do give you an answer, whether it's good or bad. And there's a certain anthropological irony in that.
And would you carry your comparison this far? One striking thing about the Oracle is that we now know that it was an utter sham. Nobody was really listening to the gods, because there were no Greek gods.
Well, that's the irony.
Off your dirty knees, not down my apex. If you split the wood, I'll start a fire. Because the sun is setting and it's only getting colder. Times are moving quickly, we're only growing older. I'm so tired of the chase. Thank you. sing you lullabies. If you call me darling, you take it slow, I have the time. Because the sun is setting and it's only getting cold.